September 23rd, 2008. This is the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. We are in room 468 in the State Capitol Building. My name is Gary Hansen. With me today are Commissioners Johnson and Colbeck. We will first check to see who's on the telephone line with us. Mr. Bob Saar.
Yes, I'm here with Jim Edwards.
Good morning. We're adjusting our sound just a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Clyde Gross, Jeff Decker.
Good afternoon. We are here.
Good afternoon. George Thompson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon. Colleen Savold.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Chris Madsen.
I'm here, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Jolene Doring.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Bob Schultzel.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Bob, give me another shot on your last name.
Schultzley.
Schultzley, thank you. Bill Vandersloos. Bill? All right, Bill will potentially not be joining us. Ryan Taylor?
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else on the line who whose name I did not call? Then we will begin with the our agenda for today as it is shown. There's one item I need to touch on first. It is my responsibility, my duty to embarrass one individual here today and call her forward into the, what is it in Britain when you stand in the circle there above with the dock? Is it the dock? Look at the barristers to find that out. Ms. Van Gerpen, would you please step forward? I don't know how many of you know this, but Patty had a magnetic car on Saturday. Please have a chair. I'm not going to make you stand through all this.
It won't be long.
Patty, we just about lost her as our executive director. She was traveling on a pier street and a semi, no less, took out her little Honda and totaled it, and she refused medical treatment because that's the way we are in the PUC. And we're glad that you made it through that. Congratulations. We're very excited for that. Yeah. Patty is one of the most, I don't want to say anything derogatory about any of our prior executive directors, of course, but Patty has to be in the top two of the executive directors who have ever served in the Public Utilities Commission. And although I haven't been here that long, I sincerely appreciate the tremendous support that you provide for us. I don't know how many of you realize, but she just, I mean, she even opens up my mail when I'm out of town and provides the, I think Sandy pays her to do that. And she makes copies of it and sends it to me so that I know what's going on and things of that nature. And it's just all those tremendous little things that we don't expect, and then taking care of all of the other challenges. And the reason that I'm doing this today is because this is your anniversary with the state of South Dakota. 25 years you have been with the state of South Dakota. Congratulations. That is very magnificent. We're very tremendously appreciative of the work that you've done with the Public Utilities Commission. You started with the state of South Dakota with the Jankel administration, is that correct?
Right.
And have seen many different administrations in your time, and as directors of director of different, I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember where you were director, but other than here, and you came here from tourism, and we appreciate your many talents, and thank you very, very much for all that you've done. You get a pin.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I am impressed with how savvy you are. I can tell you're a good politician because you said she's one of the top two, so now you can tell all the former directors, well, you were the other one I was talking about. So
that is precisely why I said that. Been in politics a little while. Well, we will start then with consumer reports. Ms. Gregg, who is one of our top two consumer persons.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. The Commission has received a total of 110 contacts since the last report was prepared for the September 9th, 2008 Commission meeting. 22 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 37 of the contacts involved electrical services, 11 contacts involved natural gas service, 6 contacts involved cell phone services, 19 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, and 1 contact involved the Keystone Pipeline, 14 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,779 of the 1,864 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved, and 2,327 of the 2,337 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved.
2,337 last year, and how many have been resolved?
2,327.
Wow, that's great. Any questions for Deb? If not, the first docket on our agenda today is under electric EL08-016. The question before the commission is, today shall the commission approve the stipulation? Second question is, shall the commission approve the construction permit? Mr. Saar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And as I noted earlier, Jim Edwards is also here as well for East River, and I am the attorney for East River. We have entered into a stipulation with staff. Staff had some suggestions from our draft stipulation that we had initially worked out, and I think probably perhaps most notable to the commission. We did acknowledge that we will work closely with the landowners and make sure that we look to solutions for the folks who have some questions about pole placement and so on and so forth. Work closely with those people to ensure that we're doing everything we can to respect their wishes, you know, while still getting the project built. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate the commission's consideration.
Thank you, Bob. Does Jim have anything to say at this time before we go to staff?
I'm closer to Mike, so I'll say he doesn't. But
that's what attorneys get paid to do. Karen, Ms. Kramer.
Good afternoon. This is Karen Kramer with staff, and I would echo Mr. Saar's comments, and staff is prepared to answer any questions. Staff, as its recommendation, would ask that the commission grant the joint motion for approval of the stipulation, that you adopt the stipulation without modification and approve the construction permit.
What was the second item you had there?
Yeah,
commission approved
the
joint motion and stipulation. Commission approved the construction permit and it seemed
adopt the stipulation without modification.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else needing to testify on this item? Commission questions? Commissioner Kovac?
I just have one question. Mr. Starr, stipulation, I think it was number 7, the applicant shall provide each landowner property of the following deals, a commission order, detailed safety, and there are some other things labeled there. How will that be mailed? Are you going to hand deliver that with your easement person, or how will those be delivered? We had the only reason I ask is we had that come up in a previous matter with a different transmission line.
I appreciate the question. That's a good one, Mr. Commissioner. We will mail that to the landowners, and you know that just seems to be the clearest and cleanest way to make sure that we get it to the owner of record.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there a motion?
I'll motion in EL08-016 that the commission approve the stipulation and also. Do you want to do these separate, or should we do them?
You can do all three. It's
and I'll also move that the commission approve the construction permit.
Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Second item on the agenda is EL 08-024 in the matter of the application of East River Electric Power Cooperative Incorporated for a permit to construct approximately 22 miles of 115 kV transmission line. The questions before the commission today are, today shall the commission grant the motion to dismiss and close the docket? And East River.
Yes, thank you again, Mr. Chairman. Bob Starr and Jim Edwards from East River. You'll recall at the last commission meeting, the commission granted a declaratory ruling regarding construction of 115 kV transmission lines. And looking at the facts involved in this particular application, the facts appear to East River to fit the declaratory ruling, so we believe that it at this point in time is appropriate to dismiss the application and would ask the commission respectfully consider dismissing the case. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
East River has filed a motion to dismiss, and as I understand, there are no interveners. Is that correct?
That is correct at this point in time, Mr. Chairman. I would note that the intervention deadline would have would just be partly through it. But I think at this point it is correct in saying that no one has intervened. And I'd also point out that the question of jurisdiction is one where I think it would strictly be a legal issue. So the whether or not the intervention deadline had passed or not, I don't think that would be relevant at this point in time.
Thank you. Staff? Ms. Kramer?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would support the motion to dismiss and close the docket.
Thank you. Any questions from commissioners? Commissioner Johnson?
I would just look to Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith, we're not making any declaratory ruling or any judgment on these. I mean, would it make sense to make that clear? We grant the motion to dismiss without prejudice and without making any sort of ruling on the facts on the case? And at this point, we're really taking East River's word for it that, this wouldn't require our approval.
Yeah, and I think if I understood what you said, Bob, and your the motion, what you're asking for here is basically a voluntary dismissal in the nature of a dismissal in the civil system under Rule 41 and not asking the commission today to render a decision regarding jurisdiction. You're just withdrawing because you've decided as a applicant that you're no longer interested in pursuing the application.
That is correct.
Thank you.
So I'll go back to my question, Mr. Smith. Is the question as written legally appropriate, or do we need to add anything to make that clear?
If you wanted to make it crystal clear, you could probably just reference it as a voluntary dismissal and without prejudice.
Do you wish to make the motion? Oh, excuse me, Commissioner Colbert.
I'm just, Mr. Smith, it's my understanding that this is just kind of a no harm, no foul dismissal.
Right.
And then if East River proceeds to build the line, the risk is actually on the East River.
I would say that it is. And again, I think the declaratory ruling was pretty clear. But again, in order for us to make a substantive ruling on jurisdiction, then we'd have to delve into the facts, and then we're in a different place. But as I understand it, East River, in reliance on the declaratory ruling, is just requesting that this filing be withdrawn, essentially. And we do that all the time in lots of cases. If a party doesn't want to prosecute an action here, generally speaking, we don't require them to do that.
Sure, as long as East River is comfortable with it, then.
But I would reiterate it, and I think that's clear from what we've said here today, but with respect to what I think you're putting in your motion is that we're not making a ruling today on jurisdiction regarding whatever East River does in this case because we haven't delved into that on a factual level here in this docket. Is that your understanding, Mr. Steyer?
Yes, it would be, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? If not, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the commission grant the motion to dismiss without prejudice and close the docket.
Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes yes. The motion carries. Next item on the agenda is natural gas, NG08-009, in the matter of the filing by Northwestern Energy for approval of tariff revisions. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the tariff revisions? Northwestern Energy.
Hi, this is Jeff Decker with Northwestern.
Hi, Jeff.
This is an annual filing, and it just simply adjusts the fuel retention or lost and unaccounted for percentage based on data from the last 12 months. What we're proposing to be effective October 1 is 1.89%. We seem to be on somewhat of a pendulum as we compare the last several years where, for example, in 05, the number was 0.6, in 2006, 1.44. Last year we dropped to 0.3, and this year we're at 1.89. All those numbers are within a realm of reasonableness. But with that swing, one of the things we're looking at, we'll see what the number comes in next year, but we may consider looking at 3 years of history as opposed to one. If we continue to have this pendulum, it just seems like when we adjust the number going forward, that number, although based on the same method, same information, the number seems to overcompensate in the upcoming year. But aside from that, we would just respectfully ask for approval of the 1.89%. Be effective October 1.
Thank you, Mr. John. Mr. Thurber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is John Thurber, staff. Staff recommends approval of the tariff revision.
Thank you. Questions?
If I could, Mr. Chairman. For Mr. Jacobson or Mr. Thurber, I mean, I know we've done a number of these over the years with Northwestern, an annual filing. I don't feel like I've seen similar filings for MidAmerican and MDU, so obviously their tariff is designed a little bit differently. Do you think this is the best mechanism to do this with a every year up and down, or what have we done with the other providers?
Yeah, I think you're correct, Commissioner, that we don't have this filing. This actually is not the broadly applicable loss and unaccounted for calculation. It's within the transportation tariff, and it's used as to mark up retention volumes. That's a way of balancing over and under transportation deliveries. So it's not the general loss and unaccounted for that's applicable to all sales tariffs. It's kind of a unique, you're right, it is a unique tariff for Northwestern. It may be, there are similar mechanisms in other transportation tariffs, however, I don't think their tariff specifically singles out this for an annual tariff change in order to incorporate the new loss and unaccounted for percentage every year. It is updated in the other companies, but we just don't approve it or see it, so.
So, but there is an annual adjustment for those other companies?
Yes.
Okay. And I suppose timing of rate cases probably, you know, had something to do with the fact that there's not continuity over how we treat each of the three providers. Is that right?
Well, yeah. It really, I can't recollect how it came up in the last rate case or how we dealt with tariff language. You know, I guess it really hasn't been an issue yet, but it could be. If we would like it to be annual tariff revision, we could check into that. But it's generally, as far as the percentages go, they're very close within company to company. They're very close, you know, as far as being in the 1.25% to 1.5% range, generally. So.
And then a question for Mr. Decker. You know, from what limited information I have on this type of on this type of calculation, I mean, 1.89 doesn't seem to be too high, but if this isn't high, I mean, what is? Is there a particular number at which it should raise a red flag with the commission or would raise a red flag with the Northwestern?
You know, I think, like on the meter losses, I think we look at what law provides. Anything under 2% is fine. I suppose once we got to the point of 3.5%, 4%, we might start getting more concerned. Although I noted in some of the national numbers there were even 5%, maybe even higher, but I know there's 5% numbers in some of those.
You mentioned national numbers. Is there an industry benchmark, standard, or goal for this type of calculation?
There may be, but I'm not positive on what that is.
Okay, thanks very much. Nothing further.
Any further questions? Excuse me, I was working ahead. Is there a motion?
I would move the commission approve the tariff revisions.
Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. Motion carries. Pipeline safety, PS08-001. In the matter of the filing of the investigation of the natural gas incident of February 20th, 2008 on Montana-Dakota Utility Company system in Pierce, South Dakota. Question before the commission is today, shall the commission adopt staff's recommendation and close the docket, or how shall the commission proceed? On September 3rd, 2008, staff filed an addendum to their initial report. So we will hear from staff first and then from the other parties. Ms. Semler?
This is Nathan Solem with staff. Staff recommends that prevention of reoccurrence is a required focus of this docket under 49 CFR 192.617. Because a second pig is in the line and could result in similar conditions as the first incident when the pig was received in Pier, staff in its addendum report studied four options to prevent reoccurrence, including scheduled arrival of the second pig via controlled gas release, proper assembly and torquing of all flanges, removal of the ignition source, and better debris handling. Staff's recommendation is that removal of the ignition source and proper assembly and torquing of all flanges be implemented. Controlled gas release and better debris handling, although desirable, may be cost-intensive and may not provide the desired cost-benefit ratio. Further, in staff's opinion, sufficient data may not be available and may not be possible to obtain to accurately determine the probable cause or causes of the incident. Staff's reports outline four possibilities: strainer gasket failure due to transient pressure from the pigging operation, sandblast destruction of the gasket due to high velocity debris, flange bolts not extending through the nuts, and improper torqued flange bolts. Lastly, with winter approaching and a resulting high gas demand day possibly drawing in the second pig, staff recommends action in a timely fashion rather than any prolonged study of probable cause or prevention reoccurrence methods.
Thank you. Ms. Summer, did you have anything to add at this time?
I don't. I think we should hear from the various parties, and Nathan and I could add any further information as necessary.
Would MDU or SDIP care to go first?
Good afternoon.
SDIP.
I'm Jim Robinow from Sioux Falls, and I represent SDIP, and we fully support the staff's
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, now you're going to be in worse trouble than you were before. As I said, SDIP fully supports the staff's conclusions and recommendations as to how to treat this incident. Let me start by saying, and I'm not going to be very long, but in some instances in this filing, there's been references to welding slag and rust. And just for the commission's edification, there are two filters in the line that filter the gas for debris such as that before it gets to MDU. These are 1 micron filters, and they are designed to stop any debris larger than 1 micron from coming through. They're essentially similar to an air filter in a car, if you've ever had that. You know, they're larger, of course, but all the gas passes, so there isn't any typical rust or welding slag that would be able to get through these filters to get to MDU's pipe. Now, having said that, there also in some of the filings in the docket, there's an assumption that the pig coming into the pig trap at the Pier station was simultaneous with the gas release. I would tell you that the pig was not discovered until after the incident had taken place and could have been there for as long as a week before it did take place, because they didn't at that time check the pig trap every day. And finally, the actual cause of the fire itself, not the gas release, but the fire, the open flame heater in the shed in which the fire occurred, has already been taken care of. So I don't know that that's going to be a problem in the future. If the gasket flange that was referred to in staff's report had been properly torqued, as I understand it, there would have been no contact between the gasket and the dust in the line. As to pressure fluctuation, it's my understanding that the only monitorable and recordable gas pressure devices in the SVIP line is where the gas comes off and into SVIP's line at Mina, and there was no gas or there was no pressure fluctuation there. They have pressure recording devices here and here, but they don't automatically keep records of what the pressure was at any given time. You have to be there personally and look at it. And that's basically what I wish to convey to the commission, and I thank you for your time or for allowing me to be here. If you have any questions, I'd try to answer them or defer to my experts sitting behind me there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Gertz.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pier, and I represent Montana, Dakota, excuse me, in this matter. With me is Scott Bessemer, who is a senior engineer in Montana, Dakota's gas distribution department, and if you have technical questions, I'd like to get him involved. He is intimately familiar with the details of this incident. Montana, Dakota is required to provide a safe and reliable gas service to its customers. However, on February 20th, 2008, Montana, Dakota was literally minutes away from being unable to provide this reliable service due to an abnormal operating condition, which was experienced on account of receiving debris in the distribution system from SDIP's pipeline. This debris ultimately caused the system to lose pressure to dangerously low levels. As a consequence, Montana, Dakota believes SDIP violated industry standards and safe practices, violated its own tariffs, and ignored its obligation to the public at large when it did not address Montana, Dakota's concerns in 2006-2007, and again when two pigs were stuck in 2007-2008, and to date, as SDIP has still made no significant effort to locate and remove the second pig. Underlying the entire scenario, Montana, Dakota is concerned with staff's recommendation, and I'm referring to the amended last recommendation, that seems to be based on a least cost versus a public safety approach. In the past, SDIP has had this same approach and procedure for an operating philosophy, and as a result, two unsafe and costly incidents have resulted. SDIP's employment of the operating factors used to draw in pigs, rather than bearing the expense of venting gas to control the pressure differential and flow to actively control movement of the pigs, which is the industry standard, is not acceptable. In the near future, SDIP must adopt a safe and proactive operational philosophy to retrieve the second pig. And Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, I want to emphasize that in MDU's mind, the concern is not the gasket. The concern is not these other factors. The concern is getting that pig out of there so that the same thing does not happen again on a February day in Pierre, South Dakota. In a perfunctory three-page response, SDIP has indicated that it will abandon pigging operations. No analysis is provided as to why SDIP chooses to change its mode of operation, other than to announce that it wishes to make a change. SDIP has made no effort to address staff's proposed prevention plan. A late exchange of data requests indicating certain costs to manipulating the existing pig by release of gas seems to have unduly affected staff's approach, as well as SDIP's approach to the problem, and I'm specifically referring to staff's statement, which I'm not sure whether they are withdrawing now, but the first revised recommendation was scheduled retriever of the pig via gas release, and then the second sentence on this recommendation that I have is that staff does not recommend that the commission order this prevention record, and it's Montana Dakota's strong recommendation that the pig is the problem and the pig needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed quickly. Montana Dakota feels strongly that if the second pig is not retrieved before the heating season, that a similar, more severe incident could occur beyond our control, and therefore we believe it is incumbent upon this commission to require SDIP to take whatever steps are necessary to retrieve the second pig. Staff mentions that it expects debris loading ahead of the second pig to be substantially less than ahead of the first pig. Although the first pig mysteriously disappeared within hours after the beginning of February 22nd, which event is not available for observation, reports indicate the first pig had lost a significant portion of its mass. Therefore, Montana Dakota believes staff is making a dangerous assumption that a similar incident will not likely occur again. Montana Dakota, as in past years, when appeals to SDIP went unheeded, is again very concerned about a catastrophic event occurring again when that second pig arrives on a cold day in Pier. Montana Dakota personnel have discussed with staff the minimum of four failures that occurred on February 20th, 2008. What we know is that SDIP's filter failed in some way, followed by Montana Dakota's filter element failing. Montana Dakota's filter element failed due to the excessive amount of rust that entered the system. Pictures given to staff clearly show that the filter element was completely clogged with no place for any further debris to go. When this happened, the rubber O-ring seal failed and the debris were allowed to bypass the filter element and continue downstream to the regulator. When the debris hit the regulator, they proceeded to knife through the rigid boot material, all the while eating away the solid steel orifice plate. Again, staff has shown both pictures of these components and physically observed them in the Bismarck Service Center. After the failure of the boot material, the regulator failed open, at which time the relief valve popped, as it is supposed to do, relieving the excess pressure and causing an abnormal operating condition. It has been and continues to be Montana Dakota's opinion that after all three of these failures occurred, the process of sandblasting and cutting away the gasket took place. The evidence of the gasket and orifice plate clearly show a cutting effect on the material and not a blown-out effect. Staff talks about cost-benefit analysis but overlooks the direct damages and cost to Montana Dakota, which now approach $200,000, with the prospect of additional damage from the pig, which is still in the pipeline. In Montana Dakota's opinion, considering the downside, this is simply unacceptable. Throughout the entire pig saga, Montana, Dakota had expressed its concern to SCIP of the potential problems that could appear, that could occur if a pig arrived unexpectedly at the pier border station without any operational response by SDIP. This is precisely what occurred, and SDIP was completely unprepared to address the arrival of the pig and the ensuing damage to Montana Dakota's equipment. Montana Dakota believes that the root cause of the gasket failure was erosion of the gasket material directly due to excessive debris introduced from the SDIP line. Contrary to staff's report, no evidence supports a determination that the flange was not torqued according to manufacturer's specifications, or that lack of torque caused or contributed to the cause of the gasket erosion. Staff has proposed that the flange holding the gasket was not sufficiently tightened. This seems to come from the observation of the absence of the flange stud ends extending full way through the nut, as somehow indicating lack of tightening. However, the construction of the flange is such that the opposing end of the stud is likewise secured by a nut. So a minimally different tightness on the backside nut would create a situation where the flange bolt does not extend full way through the nut on the other side. I stopped at the hardware store. If you've got a nut at either end and a constant piece of material between it, it depends on how much the bottom nut is tightened as to how much of the stud is going to be sticking through the top end. Without scientific tests, you can't, this is no indication whatsoever of a lack of torque. And there is no direct evidence of a lack of torque. No tests were conducted, no measurements taken, and no ergonomic studies made. The photograph of the gasket clearly shows degradation of the gasket caused by the sandblasting effect of the debris that was transported by SDIP. Scott Bessemer and I were just talking before this hearing. Had it been a structured event rather than a degradation of the gasket, there would have been a crack in the gasket rather than a wearing away of the gasket, as is indicated by the photographs. Notwithstanding that Montana Dakota does not believe that the flange torquing had anything to do with the incident, the company has retorqued all the flanges in all the stations on its system. Montana Dakota has agreed to remove the building heater, and it has been removed. However, these issues do not address the root cause of the issue, which is likely to occur again, that being the significant debris will plug the system, causing loss of service to the cities. Beyond the foregoing, Montana Dakota must take what comes from SDIP. And it is submitted that Montana Dakota has no obligation to expect that SDIP would not operate its system prudently. Yet we know a pig is still in the system somewhere, and SDIP has done nothing to cure that situation. Finally, 49 CFR 192.605 requires SDIP to have a procedural manual for operations, maintenance, and emergencies. Among other things, the manual must address starting up and shutting down any part of the pipeline in a manner designed to assure operation within maximum allowable operating pressure limits prescribed by the rules. It should also address abnormal operations, including responding to, investigating, and correcting the cause of increase or decrease in pressure flow rate outside normal operating limits, loss of communications, operation of any safety device, and any other foreseeable malfunction of a component, deviation from normal operation, or personal error, which may result in hazard to persons or property. Before this hearing, a couple of weeks ago, Montana, Dakota asked SDIP to produce this manual. They refused to produce it. I can only draw one conclusion from that. They either don't have a manual or there's something in that manual that will show a deficiency. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, we do agree with what Mr. Solomon said, and that is that this requires action. This requires action now. The concern is not the gasket. We want to prevent another incident. The pig is still there. Something needs to be done. If that same, as I said at the outset of my presentation, and Scott Desmer can amplify on it if you need further particulars, but the incident that occurred earlier this year came within minutes of backing all the pressure out of the entire system and causing the entire system to go down. That would mean that it would take Montana, Dakota up to 3 days to get the system back up. And in the meantime, people would not have gas. Now, if that were to happen on a cold February day, that would indeed be a serious incident. Montana, Dakota does not want that to happen. And so we believe that there must be action in a timely manner, there has to be something done and done quickly to prevent this from happening, which would include locating that pig. And if you wish, as I said, I have Scott Besmer here to answer any technical questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. We may very well get to that and ask him questions. However, the testimony of the three folks has probably brought up more questions than what we had when we started. So we're certainly, rather than the commissioners starting to ask the questions, give staff and SDIP an opportunity to answer or at least give us some additional focus on those questions. Please, Ms. Semler.
Thank you. This is Kara Semler for staff. I'd just like to emphasize the pipeline safety staff's goal in this incident investigation, and it is to find a fast, effective, efficient prevention plan. Cause has not been determined, and that's not what our investigative purpose, that being pipeline safety staff's investigative purpose, is in this sort of an incident. Rather, our purpose in the investigation is to determine if there were any pipeline safety violations made, any federal code violations or South Dakota statute violations, and there have been none. And MDU has not made a statement that there have been any such violations made. They're referring to industry standards or a tariff violation possibly, and I just don't believe that's what this docket is intended to do. If those sorts of violations do exist, and MDU feels they have been damaged, certainly this commission may have jurisdiction and they may want to file a complaint, and the commission may want to have a hearing, hear witnesses, hear experts speak on those items, but that just simply is not what this docket is about. There have not been any code or statutory violations, and none of those then lack of violations caused this incident to happen. Staff does feel confident that our recommendation, the tightening of the flanges, and the removal of the ignition source will prevent a potential fire that may or may not happen. There may not be as much debris. It may not even reoccur as it did last winter. And I'll answer any questions that you may have, but I think it's just important to focus on what we as pipeline safety staff, what our goal is and what our purpose is and what we're to do with this particular incident.
Thank you, Ms. Semler. And I don't disagree with you on what you're saying, and without having spoken with the other commissioners on this issue, I'm still going to stretch the envelope a little bit on our jurisdiction because of the potential for some other challenge. It may, we still need to follow the law and determine whether or not we have any additional jurisdiction, but certainly staff's recommendations may ultimately be exactly what we adopt. But in the
with the concern that there may be some potential challenges here that can be rectified if we stretch our envelope just a little bit at this juncture. I will pursue that. Ms. Weiss, did you have anything at this time, or did you want to wait till after? Okay. Would like to hear from Mr. Robineau or one of the Woods in regards to, I'm intimately familiar with pigging when it has to do with water, not with natural gas and screening and et cetera. But share with us, please. We've heard that, and we understand from what we've read that there's some disintegration of one of the pigs without knowing where it is. Is there a portion of a pig? Is there debris that could block this line eventually? Gordon, would you please share with us?
Yes, sir. Gordon Woods, Commissioner Hanson, commissioners. As far as, is there a pig in the line right now? Would that be the question?
It seems to be MDU's contention that there's at least debris from a pig or a mass in the line from a pig, and their concern is that it's going to block the line some, and certainly that if that's a valid concern, then we all need to be concerned with that.
Yes, sir. There is a pig in the line right now. Where is it in the line? I am not sure. When you put the pig in the line, you launch it, you have a tracking device, locates the pig throughout the line. And the tracking device is battery operated. It has two AA cell batteries. To keep it light so it'll travel through the line, it doesn't have a big battery behind it, you know, powering it. That lasts about 5 to 6 days. If your pig becomes lodged in the pipe somewhere, or you lose the location of that while it's traveling in the line, highly likely that you're going to lose the location of the pig until it comes home, because your batteries are going to die. You're not going to know where it is in the line. So yes, we do have one in the line, and yes, I do not know where it is.
And
it is a whole pig. It's not, and it doesn't have a trailing device behind it like the first pig, which I have in my office if anybody would care to come look at it. The first device had a trailer behind it that just pulled the tracker behind it. The one that's in there now is a solid one whole piece. It has a hollow body. You put the tracking device inside that body of the pig. So, and it is in the pipe.
Exploring things that I don't know that we need to explore, but I'm curious. Why is it not possible to dislodge the pig with another pig or put pressure behind it? And how is it possible that the natural gas continues to go past and the pipe functions with the pig in the line?
Well, the pig is just made to be a little bigger than the inside of the pipe. But gas will get around it. Let's say, for instance, if it gets into an elbow or a 45, it'll leave a space for gas to get around. The pig actually wears down. These are like a hard rubber cups on them. Traveling through that pipe, that metal will wear that down, so that when it gets smaller the further it goes through the pipe. The volume of gas is theoretically should push that pig through the line. When you have fluctuating gas flow, as we do in this line, where some days it's very, very low, it doesn't push it along. It may stop. It may pick up again. We actually manipulated our pressures throughout the winter, last winter, to try and keep that moving through the line.
Is this likely to dislodge itself eventually and create the challenge that MDU is concerned with?
It may dislodge itself. Some pigs, in talking to different experts in the industry, sometimes it takes up to 250 days for one to get through a line because of the low flows in the pipeline. So, yes, there's a good possibility that it'll dislodge itself. As far as all this debris, rust, welding slag, quite frankly, there's no welding slag inside of our pipe. Whatever comes through there goes and drops out in our pig trap. If it doesn't drop out in our pig trap, it flows through and gets into our filter. So we do have a filtering system in place to catch as much as possible that we can catch. It works very well. We check it once a week, especially throughout the winter. Now, right now in the summer months, we don't check it once a week because there's virtually no flow in the pipeline to push anything through. When a flow gets higher, we check that filter once a week. We would certainly be willing to check it twice a week if you know, that would alleviate anybody's concerns. We are still flowing through our pig trap in the hopes that our pig comes in.
I'm assuming that it's cost that you're not interested in pursuing another method of removing it.
Well, other than blowing gas, going to a block and just blowing gas straight out of the pipeline I have no idea how long it may take to do something like that, whether it takes 1 hour or 5 days, you know, the cost can be extremely high.
And you need to continue to move gas through this line.
There's an environmental
high pressure
concern.
Air to go through. You've got to maintain the gas in it.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, it's an environmental issue with just blowing gas straight up in the air for 2 or 3 days. We feel that it will come in, and we don't anticipate it coming in with a huge amount of debris in front of it. We didn't have a huge amount of debris come in front of it in February either.
I'm familiar with natural gas traps for debris. I think every house has them, but curious if there's any other questions first from the commissioners before I ask Ms. Wiest if she has anything to add. Any other questions from the commissioners?
Yeah, Gordon. Then it states in their reply to staff that MDU's filtering system in PIER is the same as SDIP's. To your knowledge, is that correct?
Yes. Their filter is a smaller filter than ours, but we both use a 1 micron filter.
Okay.
So anything 1 micron and larger will be stopped by that. And quite honestly, I'm not even sure if you can get a smaller filter. I don't know that for a fact.
Was your gas would have to pass through your 1 micron filter before it would reach theirs, correct?
Yes, sir.
So was your 1 micron filter destroyed in February?
No, it was not destroyed. It had dust in it. As it does, we keep a log of it. I have the dust, the log of all of the dust we've taken out. We don't keep the filters because, quite frankly, they don't smell very good.
Okay.
And so we weigh the amount of the filter weighs. When we take it out, we throw it away.
I guess I'm confused as to how, and maybe this is a better question for MDU's expert, but how would MDU's filter be ruined if yours wasn't? How could waste get through a 1 micron filter and then destroy a 1 micron filter on the other side?
Quite possibly, and I actually have seen this happen on MDU's system. When you're blowing, when their relief valve releases, blows the gas, it causes a big suction. It may, when it vented, and this is just speculation, but when it blew, it sucked that filter out. It could have sucked that filter out.
So there is a reasonable, possibly another reasonable explanation.
Certainly there is, and just to elaborate on that, when MDU was doing some pigging on their line over here on 4th Street, they were running a pig through a line through that type of filter, blowing it to atmosphere. When they had a big differential built on it, it blew the filter out. So. That would be my speculation on what might happen.
Now, do you own, is it your responsibility to move the ignition source? Or
no,
the MDUs?
No, we have no ignition source on any of our facilities.
Okay.
Okay, the new fixture, the flanges. Mr. Gertis' question about a manual, do you have that manual?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You just didn't have that on for 15 years. Would it be, it'd be a violation, though, if you didn't have that, correct?
Yes. And
no violations were found by staff.
So. Actually, when we had to have that manual when we built our pipeline and produced it for the Public Utilities Commission prior to going into operation. And Nathan inspects our manual, and before Nathan Martin had inspected our manual for 14 years.
Okay.
Once or twice a year. Martin did twice a year, Nathan's done once.
Sure. Have you ever had a pig run through this line problem-free, or is this the first one you've seen?
We haven't run any pigs in our pipeline since it was built.
Okay.
Pigs were run in it when it was built to dewater the line. And the only reason we're running pigs right now, quite frankly, we wouldn't run them if we didn't have to. The reason we're running them now is to comply with the government's subpart O of Part 192, which is the integrity management. And you run a pig through there. Basically, we were trying to run a pig through it so that we could make sure we could get an electronic pig through that pipe with no obstructions.
And then in your rebuttal, it also mentioned that you will not in the near future insert any pigs unless directed by the property appropriate authority. Would that be the feds then, or the PUC? Or?
Well, it would be either the federal government or the PUC, and I know okay. that you adopt their rules. So what we're doing instead of, there's two ways of doing integrity management. One is to run an internal inspection tool through the pipeline, i.e. electronic pig. When you, that would go through and take a picture of the whole entire pipe section and, you know, produce all the data and put it on a computer for you. There's another method where it's more labor intensive, it's more costly, but it's to go out and do a external corrosion direct assessment and an internal corrosion direct assessment. And the ECDA external corrosion part of it is done in your high consequence areas. The internal corrosion is considers your whole pipeline, one segment, and you may do digs on your pipeline outside of your HCAs. Right now we've just finished all of our data gathering for our ECDA part of that right now. So we're halfway through with it. We're going to start ICDA in about a month, and so we won't have to put a pig in the line and look, try and inspect it that way.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Kolbeck had some good questions about your filter. I think MDU had mentioned that they installed their filter maybe not all that long ago. If your traps and filters were fully functioning, would a filter downstream, so to speak, be necessary?
They've had a filter in there downstream from us, and they had it in there before we actually had ours in.
Oh, okay.
We had two before 2000 and I'm going to say 2004. I'm not sure. I'd have to look. We had a 5-micron filter in. We removed that from our system and put a 1-micron in because dust was getting by, and they had a filter in front of that catching that dust. So once we had removed the 5-micron, we went through the 1-micron filter. It virtually stopped all the dust getting through there. I won't say that none gets through. Some dust that may be smaller than 1 micron will get through it. So
if the battery life wasn't sufficient in the first pig, why send a second pig through the same line with the same battery setup?
That's a good question. That's what there is out there to use. And sending the second pig, it was in an attempt to try and locate and move the first pig along, help get through the line. The first pig actually went in the line in around Thanksgiving of 2007. So it wasn't, and the second pig went in February of 2008.
So, to me, the timing of this is interesting. There's insufficient flow on the line, and yet the first pig was put in November of 07. So, during the high use months of, you know, December, January, February, there wasn't sufficient flow to...
No, we do it in the winter because the flow is higher.
Mm-hmm.
What we've ultimately come to the conclusion is the flow is just not high enough.
So it was
you don't really know until you do.
So under typical operating pressure, even during winter months, there isn't, it's unlikely that any pig put in a system would be able to go from point A to point B while still maintaining adequate battery strength?
In our system? I will say I don't think so for our system, and that's why we've decided not to put a pig in again.
Well, and I know we're getting a little, you know, fact specific on some of these questions, but, you know, staff alluded to 192.617. I mean, that talks about, you know, the operator analyzing accidents and failures to determine the cause and to minimize the possibility of reoccurrence. So that's what some of my questions are coming from. I'm trying to get an idea of, for you all to comply with 617, you know, how do we ensure that you're minimizing the possibility of reoccurrence? So, I mean, I thank you for the latitude. Mr. Chairman, if I could have a couple questions to staff, if that's okay?
Please.
So I thought, I think MDU raised some important issues with regard to your revised recommendations 1 and 4, essentially no longer recommending the retrieval of the pig in the instance of 1, and under 2, not requiring an improved filter system. Mr. Solon, you described a bit of that, but could you add a little meat onto those, onto your explanation?
My feeling is that with the removal of the ignition source, the chance of an exact reoccurrence of this incident is fairly small. So then it becomes, when the pig comes in, it may, if it blows a filter and debris does get through both filters and trips their relief valve, takes out the regulator, that is a release that's still controlled, and it may not be as necessary to have staff on hand in that case as it would be if there was still an ignition source there and the possibility of recurrence of a fire. That's one area. Does that answer your question, or did I?
Well, I think it starts to address number one. You don't think they've got that they should be required to go in and get the pig because you don't think, absent an ignition source, that the risks are anywhere near as high as they were with an ignition source.
I think the risks are significantly less. Absolutely, getting the pig out of there would be great. It's a question of is it worth the cost, and who's going to pay for it?
Do you agree with the characterization of Montana Dakota regarding how severe the situation was and a few moments away from essentially system shutdown?
That would be accurate based on interviews I had with them in investigating the incident. Yes, the pressures were very low, if that's what you're referring to.
You, staff retained Alan Seltz, I think.
Yes.
And did he provide you any information or analysis other than the one-page memo that you included in the docket?
There was a short report, not much longer than what's in the first report that was filed separately. That is the extent of his report. Yeah.
Did he have any? I mean, he speculates a bit on the cause. It didn't appear as though his resume showed that he had a lot of, or as much expertise and analysis in
sort of your job, trying to figure out, you know, the recommendations and what should be done on a go-forward basis. Did he provide you any recommendation on the issues 1 and 2 in your revised recommendations?
No.
Why does staff under revised recommendation number 4 not believe that an improved debris handler would make sense? And I know you talk both in 1 and 4 about a cost-benefit analysis, but we don't have a lot of hard numbers.
That's right.
And so if it's, I'm just trying to get a feel from you, if it's so clear-cut that the costs are so high and the potential risks are so low that it's not worth diving into to get some additional data.
I had a very rough number on the filter system cost. That would probably be better directed to one of the operators. They would have a better feeling for what a larger system that would take that debris load without collapsing the filter would cost. They could probably estimate that better than I can.
Well, and you know, we may ask for that, but I mean, walk me through what you all talked about and analyzed and why you arrived at the decision you did with regard to recommendation 4.
Okay, first let me clarify. It's not that I don't think improved debris handling would be good in case that the actual cause of the incident was the sandblasting effect. It's the cost may be in the vicinity of $20,000, and there may be too long a lead time to implement something before winter hits.
And so that second point kind of becomes an important one. If you don't think it can be done now, then I suppose the benefit of such an action is, am I right in assuming there's quite a bit that the benefit is reduced significantly if you wait to do it after the pig comes in?
Right. If they're not putting another pig in, once this pig is out, then there should be no more issue.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any further questions this time?
I'm sorry, I actually have one more. Someone used the phrase, you know, excessive rust. Give me an idea, a menu of situations that would cause excessive rust to be within a pipeline. I mean, is there more than... Go ahead, Mr. Woods.
I would say that quite frankly, it's not excessive rust, it's dust. I have some samples of it in my office if you'd like to see those. When you dewater your pipeline after it's built, inevitably there is still some water left in it unless you actually dehydrate it, which was not done when we built our line. So in some of your low spots, you will have water sitting in your pipe. That water will be picked up by the gas stream and moved down the line and cause some surface rust inside the pipe. We dried our line out with methanol to try and minimize the amount of water that was in our line. So you'll have some scrubbing effect even with the gas going through the pipe, which will cause dust. They actually call it pipeline rouge. It's just a combination of perhaps like a light surface rust and maybe some dirt that was in the pipe and so forth.
To my understanding, water is the primary cause of internal corrosion.
Sure.
Could the excess that... So if we know there's water in the pipeline, there's whether it's excessive, you know, rust or dust or rouge, could any of that be an indicator that there's a higher than acceptable level of internal corrosion taking place within the pipeline?
It could be, but with all of the cathodic protection we have on our system, all the testing we do on our system, it doesn't show any corrosion on the system. We've actually cut our pipeline open in three or four different places, and I have pictures of that if you'd like to see those, but it looks just like the day it was put in. So that gives you a sample of what it looks like inside.
Thank you, Mr. Kolbeck. Commissioner Kolbeck, excuse me.
What was the last known position of the pig that's in the pipe right now?
To the best of my knowledge, we think it's between Oneida and Pier. in our line, and I couldn't say exactly where. It's about a 29-mile stretch. It may be as close as 10 miles out, but I don't really, unless we knew where it was, I could tell you, but I have no way of locating it and telling you where it is.
Is there any way, since you know you can isolate that 29-mile stretch, is there any way, I suppose you can't, can you? You can't just work with that 29 miles without affecting your entire system.
Not really. It'll affect the gas coming in here.
Is there any way to put a camera down there, or I suppose any of that technology? Or
no, I've looked at several. Basically, once you can't find it, you can't find it. Unless you put another pig in and bump into it.
Well, and
that's not.
Yeah,
we don't plan on doing that.
Low flow for one, there's going to be low flow for two. So.
Yep. Our highest flows are in the wintertime, and that's why we did it in the wintertime.
And there's just one question I forgot from the first one. What is the pig receiving station? How does a pig come out of the line without making things go to overflow?
You have a T in your line where you can close a valve over here, and you run all your gas through this pig trap. Basically, it's a pipe that's above ground, comes up the same diameter of the line pipe, and then it gets bigger so that when your pig shoots in there, you can get it out easily. But what you will do is close off this. On our system, you close this valve setting off, you reroute all your gas through this pig trap, and then it has a pipe at the very front end of the trap that flows the gas through and back into your system. So then if your pig comes in, you close the valves at the end of the trap, you open up the other valves, and you route the gas into normal operation, open your pig trap, and
take it out. Oh, okay.
Or
thank you.
If it's there. Yeah.
There are other simpler types of traps, too, like the ones in residential properties, commercial properties, where the piping just extends further down, and then there's an elbow above that, and they use gravity to gather the debris. Do you have anything like that?
No, we don't. We have a pretty standard pipeline big trap.
Okay.
That's basically the way most of them are done. Some of the newer ones, I will say, are built differently to accommodate the smart pigs, electronic pigs.
Okay.
So they have some different piping configurations.
Mr. Colbert?
Yeah, sorry. This is
still Commissioner. Commissioner Colbert.
Last one I have. Is there a risk of the pig rusting in the pipe?
No.
Okay. It's all rubberized.
The body of it's steel in where the cups bolt on. You have a picture of it right under your elbow. Flip the page.
Right here.
Yes, sir. That's about exactly what it looks like. The cups are a rubber-type material, but the body's steel. But unless you have some way to make it induce rust to the pig, it won't rust.
And you said that sometimes it could stay in there for 250 days. Yes, how long has this existing pig been in the pipe?
Since February 5th.
February 5th?
Yeah.
I think I've got that information. Thanks.
Ms. Royce?
Yeah, I had a couple questions. Mr. Solomon, did you inspect that first pig then? Did you see it?
Yes, I did.
And I think MDU raised the question about, debris in a second incident, and that the first pig may have lost a significant amount of its mass, which could mean that when the second one came through, there would be more debris. Did it lose any of its mass?
There was some mass loss.
And you don't think that's significant enough to potentially cause a problem with that second one, if that would push out that debris out?
I honestly don't know.
And then under the manual, SDIP's manual, I'm assuming there's no provisions in there that address how to handle a lost pig, and no rules, federal rules, that address that issue?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. And then I had a question for MDU. Yeah. If you were to see the first pig and you would determine that it had not degraded sufficiently, would you have a better idea as to whether you think that second pig could cause a similar problem as to the amount of degradation in that first pig?
Well, if it hasn't degraded to the point where it's going to allow debris to go around it, then yes. I mean, if it pushed out all the debris that's in front of it and there was no way of debris getting past it, then yeah, that we'd be comfortable with knowing that the second debris load caused by the second pig wouldn't be as much as the first one. But as he was stating, that as pigs go around corners and so forth, they do lose contact with the wall, which allows gas flow to go around them.
Mm-hmm.
That also allows debris flow to go around them. So, I mean, just because the pig isn't degraded doesn't mean that debris got by it and got behind it, which the second pig would possibly pick up and bring in.
So if the first pig wasn't that degraded, you still would have the same concern as to the arrival of the second one?
I would.
Okay.
You have a pig in the line, and whether or not the flow or whatever stopped that pig is not the concern. The concern is that there's a pile of debris in front of it that's possibly holding it in there. I mean, if the flow is enough to bring in the first one, the flow should have brought in the second one, unless there's debris maybe holding it back also.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
Mr. Islov?
Thank you, Chairman. This is directed to you, Mr. Bethmer. Do the nuts always self-loosen if the pressure? I mean, you talked about, I think Mr. Curtis talked about the nuts can, you know, we're talking about two sides and how they'll lean to one side and perhaps they'll loosen. I could you explain that to me?
They will not loosen. They are torqued. There's a gasket material between the two flanges. The torquing of that nut compresses that gasket material. So the only way that those bolts will come loose is if that gasket material disappears or they're loosened manually. Or there's a vibration in the system which...
Well, let me ask this then. Aren't those... And again, I don't know anything about it other than, I'll tighten nuts around a gasket of some sort every now and then, an O-ring, whatever. But it seems like if I have it tight, it's very hard for material to get in there and work on those gaskets. I'm not saying that, I've got perfect knowledge, but it just seems...
The gasket material is of a certain thickness, which, I mean, if you look at it, how two flanges go together, you can see the gasket material. It's there. I mean, it's thick enough to where you can see it. It's not compressed down to where, as you're stating, I think that debris can get at it. Debris can get at it because it's thick enough that there is an opening between the two flanges where that gasket's at, and debris can get in there.
How thick is that gasket?
Oh, boy, I would speculate maybe a 32nd of an inch.
So it's a real small gasket.
Yeah.
And how tight do you have it torqued?
I'm not sure of the torque spec foot-pounds, but I would assume that it's quite high, 50 to 75.
It'd hurt my finger if it was in there.
Absolutely.
Okay, just one other question. You said there was retorquing. I don't know who said it. Something about retorquing on the system other than just this particular spot. What was the result of that retorquing? Were there other loose...
No. We went through what Nathan is referring to when it states that we retorqued our bolts.
Mm-hmm.
That particular flange has, you can't put a stud. A stud is one that has a nut on one end and it's solid on the other end.
Right.
We have to put a bolt, a bolt is the one with the nut. A stud is one that has two threads. It's threaded on both ends. We have to use that type of a bolting system because the bolt head will not allow that stud to be put in there, the bolt to be put in there. So you put the threaded part, all of it through the bolt, or through the holes of the flange, and then you put a nut on one side and screw it up, and then you pull that out and then put the nut down in there and screw that stud back into the other one, and then you torque them together.
I have one last question. Have you ever seen, other than what's alleged here, that type of loosening anywhere else on the system or aware of it before in your experience?
I'm not aware of it.
But haven't there been conditions where there may have been debris that have gotten through and that could have eaten it if this, other than just in this one particular case?
I have seen instances of debris getting through there, but I've never seen it to the point where it's eaten out a gasket. It's always went through the regulators, tore up the regulators. We've actually have, from the same system in 2004, steel regulator bodies that have been eroded away. The steel eroded away, but it goes out the stack of the vent.
Why would this be different in this case, then? Because, I'm looking at a double filtering system. It just seems odd to me that...
The only thing that I can conclude from this is that the debris load in this instant was so substantial that it was not able to flow out of the system, out the blow-off stack, in a timely manner, allowing it to blast around, so to say, in those flanges and piping.
Perhaps someone from SDIP could answer this for me. MDU is... contends that it would take approximately 3 days to remove, if this pig should be dislodged and end up lodging again further down the line. It would take, might shut down the line for 3 days. Is that, would you care to address that for me? Will it take 3 days, and is it likely to shut down the line if it does dislodge?
I can't speak for MDU. What they were saying is if they lost the town, it would perhaps take them 3 days to relight the whole town.
Oh, I see.
Is what I
understand. Thank you.
Understanding.
What, if it does dislodge, what's the likelihood that it will block both your screen and their screen? Is it likely to just block your screen? Or is it likely to just move further down the line?
I can't say. I don't know what's in the pipe. If it could be sitting in the pipe right now, just vibrating and not moving, and gas is going by it freely. So if it moves, and it would take a lot of flow to get it to move, I'm sure. I don't know. I can't say. You know, if it would bring a lot of debris in with it or not. I will say this. The amount of debris that we had in our filter on that day in particular was not as much as we had had in our filter on previous times, as far as weight goes, because we judge it by how much it weighs. So it wasn't the largest amount of dust we ever had in our filter.
So the first pig was removed how?
It just came in the pig trap and we took it out.
And you had to manipulate a valve in order for that to take place? Or
yes, yeah.
Because you were anticipating its arrival.
We've been flowing, and we're still flowing through our pig trap right now. We've been actually flowing through our pig trap since... probably November of last year.
So if this dislodges, you anticipate that it will flow through the pig trap?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Okay. The pig will come in the trap and
debris should be lodged within the filtering system that you have.
Correct. Because anything, whether it goes through the pipe in the normal operation or if it goes through flowing through the pig trap, it all goes through the filter. So it doesn't matter whether we're flowing through our pig trap or we're flowing through our regular valve setting.
You have one filter?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Further questions? Ms. Wiest?
Sir.
Anything left?
No, I don't think so. Staff recommended, you know, that the commission order one recombination of the prevention methods. I guess at this point I would ask the commission
commissioners whether there was sufficient information to go forward. I didn't know if any more information was needed, for example, the improved debris handling method. As to the cost, if they were doing a cost-benefit ratio, do we need further information on that, or if you think you have enough information to go forward at this time?
Mr. Chairman, point of order. We were never given any sir rebuttal. I put Mr. Bessemer up there to answer one question.
Mr. Curtis, we're not even, we're not quite done with, we're not to commissioner action here.
I thought you were finishing.
No.
Thank you.
No. We may have another whole round. Who knows? Ms. Weiss, did you have some other?
Well, that was about it. The question was whether you know, the questioning here raised more questions that the commission would like answered before making a final decision on this.
Okay. Thank you. Did any commissioners have an answer to that at this juncture?
Well, I'll hazard the first shot at it. I'm a little concerned the pig is still in there. I don't have any problem taking Mr. Sullen's word for it that the risk is significantly reduced given that the circumstances have changed. To answer Ms. Weiss's question, however, I do feel like if I had some additional information on what that cost-benefit ratio looked like, what the costs were, what the most likely allocation of those costs would be, part of me says, just as an insurance policy, it might make sense to blow for a couple days, see if we can get that baby to come loose.
Thank you. Personally, I'm leaning towards some additional information myself. I would like to hear from any of the parties who would like to address the commission at this time, but are there any other questions that anyone has? If not, Mr. Curtis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I apologize for interrupting. I thought you were finishing up, and I felt that we needed to clarify some points. If I may, Commissioner Johnson just pointed out what we're fearful may not be the case, and that is that the risk is now significantly reduced, as Commissioner Johnson said. Quite frankly, Montana Dakota believes that the same thing that happened this past February could happen again. Exactly, I mean, it was back then they were waiting to run the pig into the pig trap, and this whole scenario occurred. There was the relief valve release and all that, and if I may, I'd like to call Mr. Bessemer up just to explain his understanding of how this pigging operation should work, and also in detail how the failure actually occurred, and how in his mind it can just as easily happen again with the situation we have now, if I may.
Please.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Understood we weren't going to receive any evidence there.
No, we don't operate quite the same way as a courtroom. We're interested in just continuing to gathering as much information as we can. We haven't shut the door on anyone yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I hope I didn't slam any judges when I... We're not quite like that. We're interested in gathering information. Please continue.
Typically, a pipeline pigging operation, you model your pig to flow down the pipeline in a certain amount of time so your batteries do not lose charge, so you can track it, and also so that the cups on the pig do not degrade to the point where it's not doing its job. To do that, usually you determine the flow, the velocity that it takes to move that pig a certain speed. In order to do that on a pipeline system, you have to blow a valve. They talk about a pig trap and on their system, and that's what they're relying on, trapping the debris and everything else. In a typical pigging operation, that pig trap has a blow-off stack on it, and you determine how much you open that valve on that blow-off to get the velocity required to move that pig at a certain speed so you know the time that it's going to come in. The way that it was done here was to put it into the system and rely on the flow in Fort Pier and Pier to bring that pig in. No calculations were made as far as, oh, how much gas is used on a certain day or anything to determine when that pig is going to arrive. So it was allowed to just sit in the line and sit in the line until we hit a really cold day, which was the February 20th day. I believe it was 20 below zero, and that brought that pig in. With that pig coming in, I mean, it was flowing through their pig trap at that time, so all the debris came in with that pig, through that pig trap, through their line that goes into the system that gets filtered, and it is our opinion at MDU that that first filter in their system collapsed as ours did. And when I say it collapsed, it gathered so much debris in it that it created a different pressure differential between the outlet and the inlet side of that thing, which caused the filter medium to actually crush down, allowing gas flow and debris flow over top of that filter and continue on into the system. There was so much debris load. I mean, they mentioned that they weighed theirs and it didn't have as much debris as previous. Well, that's because I believe that the debris went through over top of it into our system. Our filter canister was also collapsed because it got inundated with debris, resulting in it ceasing flow through the filter medium, causing that differential and collapsing the filter, which caused the gas and debris to continue on down the path. We have a secondary filter system ahead of our regulators that is a strainer type handler. It handles big debris like welding rust or welding slag and so forth. And it's just a screen, okay? That was inundated with debris extremely large. I would say upwards of 100 microns, 150 microns size debris. That went through that strainer and tore it apart, and the debris went through that into our regulators, knifed through the boots of the regulators, which caused them to fail open. And when they fail open, they flow as much gas as behind that. That overpressurizes the system in Pier, which now our relief valve blows, protecting the Pier system from that overpressure. That debris blows out the stack and so forth. So I don't believe that tightening a bolt or removing the heater, because respectfully, that heater and the fire was not what damaged the system. What damaged the system was the debris. The expense and the reason for the incident was is that we had a gas release and we had a damage in above $50,000. All that was caused by debris load, not fire. So to eliminate the ignition source would not eliminate this incident or this type of situation happening again, or to tighten the flange bolts, because the flange itself, when that flange blew out, did not release so much gas that the pressure fell in Pier. That is not the reason for the pressure loss in Pier. The pressure loss in Pier is that our regulators were destroyed by the debris, and the relief valve was destroyed by the debris, allowing it to blow all the gas, vent all the gas out of the Pier system. So it is my opinion that if allowed to operate like they are now and wait for that pig to come in on a crucial day where we have high flows, I'm not so sure that the thing will not happen again, because for one, there's nothing changed. We still have the same two filters in there. We still have the strainer in place. We still have the relief in place. I mean, there's nothing changed from this other than waiting on a second pig and not knowing when it's going to happen. And it is going to happen probably in the most crucial time of the year when our flows on our system are at their highest, and that's always when it's the coldest. And if MDU's system does go down, it does take a while, because we have to, if the system pressure drops below what will sustain a pilot light in your house, we have to shut that system down according to federal regulations. In shutting that system down, we have to go and shut every riser, every commercial, every residential riser off, put our system back into service, purge out the air that's in there, and then go back to every one of those risers and open that up and purge the house piping or piping in the commercial building, and then relight the pilot lights. That will take easily 3 days. We had a Mandan ran out of gas this last winter, and that one took us 3 days. That was 5,000 customers. So we got lucky there because of the temperature was in our favor. But that's what we're concerned with. We're concerned that if allowed to continue forth with the way it is and wait for that pig to come in whenever that flow gets up there, we're going to have the same problem. Maybe if the debris load isn't as high, it won't crush the filters if we're lucky. But I don't think that's a risk we all want to take. I mean, you're talking about losing the heat to houses in an extreme temperature.
Your testimony is compelling. Does it, notwithstanding the challenge and the other issues that we have before us here, does it make sense to have another screen in there, a high tensile strength, larger screen that would screen out larger debris and protect those smaller ones?
You mean downstream of the two filters? Are you referring to the...
I'm referring to protect the 1 micron filters with another screen, much like they do with water purification, mm-hmm. where you have a larger screen and to gather all the heavy debris before you get smaller yeah. screen.
Yes, anything that would take out material ahead of your largest or your smallest filter medium.
Is there such an animal?
I imagine there is. There's all kinds of different filtering systems that you can put on pipelines.
Yeah, there's lots of different types of pigs, too.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions? Mr. Smith.
I just wanted you to ask a question, your opinion, I guess, on STIPs. I guess what was an offer to or a commitment not that they're not going to use pigs in the future and use an alternative integrity management technique. What would be your opinion on our order, I guess, prohibiting them from introducing any more pigs into that line without this commission's approval, which then would be subject to whatever operational characteristics we thought were appropriate for introduction of a pig into that system?
I guess I'm not real clear on what you asked me. I mean, do you think that entering another pig into the system is not appropriate, or?
They've said they're not going to, and so far now we've had, a major problem once, potentially a major problem twice, so they're saying they're not going to do it anymore. I guess my attitude on it is, if the pigs are going to cause that much problem in this particular line, that maybe, and there is an alternative integrity management approach, that I'm not saying it, I'm just asking your opinion, if maybe they shouldn't put pigs into this line, at least without maybe some different operational characteristics or something like that in the future. And I'm just asking your opinion, if you have one. If you don't have one, don't say anything.
Yeah, my opinion is that they operate their pipeline however they want to. I mean, that's not for us to guess or choose for them to do.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Colbeck.
When you say that the damage will be done again, you mean basically everything except the fire, correct? Because if the ignition source is removed?
Well, I can't say that a fire will not occur. I mean, you're talking about a hazardous material, natural gas. Mm-hmm. If it's mixed right with air and there's an ignition source from anywhere, the fire could occur. I can tell you that the fire will not occur from the ignition source that was there before because it's no longer in service.
Okay.
But like I was saying before, the fire was non-consequential to what happened. I mean, that scorched inside of the building. That did not destroy the equipment in that building. The debris destroyed the equipment.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Any further questions? Ms. Semler, did you have something?
Yeah. I'm
still do have a concern that, you know, if we want to determine cause, I feel like we should almost jump into a formal hearing and we should take evidence and we should have witnesses. There should be an opportunity to cross-examine. And, you know, in response to Mr. Robinault's comment about evidence, and I did make that comment, the commission's not taking, you know, evidence here today. There's not an opportunity to object, all that good stuff. But if we want to really determine cause, I feel like we should jump into a formal hearing so everyone's afforded those due process rights.
Thank you. Good suggestion. Mr. Robinault?
I second that.
Did you speak to the mic, please? And
I agree with what Ms. Semler says. I mean, it's almost like we're going halfway here and not taking all the evidence that's available regarding the causes and the preventability in the future of the same thing happening.
Thank you. Mr. Curtis.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Ms. Semler that this was not designed to be a fact-finding hearing. I believe the purpose of the hearing was to either adopt the report or not. The commissioners have been asking questions of all witnesses that are technical in nature, so I wouldn't blame Mr. Bessemer for talking about the same things the other witnesses were. But I do agree that the purpose of this hearing was limited, and it's certainly not a fact-finding hearing. That having been said, we have to figure out some way to do something pretty quickly, because the heating season is starting in about a month.
Absolutely.
So,
and your last statement there is the reason that we have made this protracted discussion. I think we all recognize that, you know, what type of mission we were responsible for and as far as what the parameters of this meeting were, but at the same time we recognize that there appears to be a challenge out there that could create some significant problems down the line, and that's why our curiosity and interest was piqued during that time. From my standpoint, I think I know how I will rule on what's before us at this time, but I think there's a lot more to be said for this particular subject and we need to examine it more thoroughly. My concern is the duration of which a hearing would take and potentially end up where we go past that, the heating season anyway. My thoughts are that we dispose of what's before us at this time, but that we allow staff to go forward with a hearing and with haste to make certain that we resolve this matter. I'm interested in hearing what the other commissioners have to say.
Mr. Chairman, I might advocate for a slightly different approach, and I'll harken back to what Ms. Semler pointed out and the purpose of our role as the Pipeline Safety Office for the state. And that is to determine if there were any violations. No one has alleged that there are. And then at least under, I think it's 617, maybe 617, the operator does have to determine or does have to work to reduce, problems in the future. Presumably we've got a role in making sure that happens. We've discussed a number of risk factors, and I don't know that spending a whole lot of time on an evidentiary heavy, I don't know what that does. You know, if we find out that we're going to take a best educated guess that it was X and not Y that caused this problem, I don't think we'll ever be able to answer that with any certainty. We've got a lot of experts who disagree. What I do think we can do is we've identified a number of risk factors, any one of which could cause a problem, even if it didn't in February. And so my interest would be in having staff gather additional information on their revised recommendations 1 and 4. Not have us undergoing hearing, but having them gather additional information, allow the parties an opportunity to comment so that we can determine get more information on the cost-benefit analysis to reduce those risk factors, independent of what happened in February. It may be that the staff's initial recommendations will make a lot of sense long-term, and it may be that we'll want to tweak them a bit.
here suggesting then to continue to actually to defer the action on this particular item and to ask for additional information and then.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I think we want to work expeditiously. I mean, perhaps we would look to staff to see the soonest reasonable time they could provide us additional information on 1 and 4. And then if there's not a regularly scheduled hearing very shortly thereafter, we'll do an ad hoc.
Precisely, that's what we'd have to do. I'm just was looking at the at this particular hearing, trying to figure out what we, well, we can certainly proceed with that basis. We just won't be in a official hearing type of capacity. Go ahead.
I kind of agree. I don't think an official hearing is going to move fast enough, nor do I think that we will actually discover any violations of code. I have complete faith in staff that they've looked at that, and actually for a complete hearing, wouldn't that be the extent of our authority, is to look for violations of code, not necessarily the recommendations? We can issue recommendations without going into formal hearing, correct? Mr. Smith? Or Relaine?
Well, I think the problem now, my understanding of this proceeding is that staff had recommended the commission order one or more combinations of a prevention method. It was to go to preventing a reoccurrence of the incident. I'm not sure that we're going to what caused the incident to begin with. However, that said, going to basic due process principles, if someone is requesting a hearing now, then we probably have to have a hearing under the APA, unless somebody can tell me where I'm wrong. If we're issuing findings of fact.
Ms. Weiss, I mean, I don't know that we've got any piece of paper before us where somebody's, you know, requested a hearing. Maybe I'm wrong. And I think people have said that if we're going to continue to gather evidence in sort of an ad hoc way, I mean, what Ms. Semler started with is saying, okay, if you guys really want to try to ascertain blame, then we better do it the whole way. And I think if we quit dipping our toe in the water and instead focus on the prevention component, then I think we can probably do that with the parties working together, the staff doing a recommendation and then responding to the the revised information or the additional information we've asked for. Ms. Weiss, what's your take on that? Do you think I'm in error?
No, I think we can do that as if people are not asking for a hearing on this specific question here, and that's prevention of reoccurrence of this incident, to the extent that the commission issues an order requiring somebody to do something. And that would be my question to somebody asking for a hearing on these issues here.
Ms. Semler?
And maybe they want to have a chance to think about it, and staff could go ahead and what you suggested gather that additional information.
I don't think it's necessary to determine cause in order to prevent this reoccurrence. And I think what you just articulated, Commissioner Johnson, is accurate. I think we could do some additional collection of information, costs, et cetera. I don't think cause is necessary. It's necessary to determine cause. If we want to determine cause, I think it should be in a hearing format so official evidence can be collected and witnesses can be cross-examined. And I don't necessarily think that in this docket such a hearing would be appropriate. As I indicated, and so my previous remarks, a complaint docket, if MDU would like to file a complaint, then we would get into those sorts of issues, I think. I just don't think it's necessary or appropriate in this particular docket to determine cause.
And if I can throw out probably an inappropriate analogy, but if you get in a car accident when you've been drinking, the court doesn't say that you got in that accident because you were drinking. Maybe that was the cause, maybe it wasn't. The bottom line is they're going to address the risk factors on a go-forward basis. Let's make sure that something bad doesn't happen again, regardless of whether or not it's an identical situation to what happened in February.
In any event, we need to dispose of the item that's before us, but at the same time, if we defer it, that should in no way indicate a lack of passion on the part of this commission to find out what
occurred and to be certain that it does not occur again. I think part of the solution in making sure it doesn't occur again is to find out precisely why it happened in the first place so that we can prevent it. So I will entertain a motion to defer, but at the same time I want to be certain that the facts are found so that we can have a decision by this commission as quickly as possible to hopefully prevent instances of this nature in the future. Is there any comment from commissioners?
I just wanted to comment before Mr. Johnson made a motion, I think, but I think the staff's recommendations 2 and 3 are agreed upon. So I agree with Mr. Johnson that 1 and 4, I'd like to know why they're disagreed upon by the two parties, and with a little bit more understanding with some numbers, and hopefully take action as soon as possible and an ad hoc if it's necessary.
A need for articulating any other information that you'd like to see from staff or resolved here?
As long as we're kind of collaborating, I mean, I think that makes sense. I mean, you know, I'll look to council, but can we adopt 2 and 3 and then as a second part of the motion instruct staff and perhaps a 2-week time period? If you need more, let us know. But 2-week, provide information on 1 and 4 within 2 weeks. And again, this is just collaborative. I'm just throwing out to see what you guys think.
I'm looking for staff to see whether or not they are comfortable with that.
I'm not sure I know how much time it'll take to get information on the filter system, but we can make a try for 2 weeks and see what happens, and if not, we'll let you know.
Thank you. Commissioner Colbert?
I was just going to say if Gordon's got any luck, that pig will come home in the next 2 weeks. So
I believe it's 229 days.
It's at 229 days right now.
All right.
Chairman?
Yeah. Yes.
One other thing, could staff provide the SDIP manual also?
We can request it from SDIP. I've looked at it, but I don't have a copy of it myself.
Oh, okay.
Do you recall the last time you reviewed it?
May of this year.
Okay. Thank you. Any other information that commissioners would like to have?
Can I ask one question about that? And maybe, I just don't know, but Nathan, maybe you guys or Gordy or whomever, is there a disagreement on that cost range of using venting to get that pig out of there?
Venting meaning venting gas?
Yes. Yes.
Please use the microphone.
They have some numbers. Have you seen the numbers, sir? And I'm sorry, I don't know who you are, but there's some...
My name is Walter Woods. I'm Gordy's
okay.
Father.
Well, there's some numbers in staff's thing here, and Rolaine, I don't have my glasses, but can you read with me?
the numbers in staff were 9,200 to 55,000. The cost of loss.
Yes, I understand. The problem with picking a number is if the pig comes in, as my son said earlier, if it came in 1 hour, it's not a lot of money. If it comes in 1 week, it's a lot of money. If it comes in 2 weeks, it's an awful lot more money. And sometimes pigs will be hung up for a long time. Maybe the industry average is 250 days, or the experts say 250. The longest of my own personal knowledge I know of a pig that didn't come in on the system I worked for years and years ago was 6 months. We had a pig step offshore, and it took 6 months for it to come in. The problem with not getting the pig in is what happened on this fire, around this, I won't call it a fire, I'll call it on the incident. What happened on the incident was somehow something in the system didn't work, because we delivered the gas at the required pressure, it got through our pig trap, it got through our separator, and it got into their system. When it got into their system, something went wrong. What went wrong, I don't know. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. They talk about a whole bunch of debris that got in their strainer. I have not seen that debris. I have not seen whether it's a welding rod, half of a welding rod, or it's a little tiny flake of a welding rod that got in a strainer. So I don't know what happened. I just know there was a result. I do know that over time, this pig will come in. Gordy, didn't we put some pressure things on to monitor the pressure when the pig comes in now?
Sorry, this is the wood brothers.
we have put new instrumentation on our line, and in Pure in particular, to give us a better read of what the pressures are doing in Pure. It gives us a real time monitoring of the differential on the filter. Quite frankly, right now in the summertime, we're not doing very much of anything because we have no flow. There's very, very little flow. For the month of August, about 17,000 MMCFs went through our line, which is very, very little compared to, say, a peak day in the winter where we might get 7.5 million. So we don't, you know, right now we're not doing a lot to watch for a pig to come in. We'll check our filter, we'll check our pig trap, but from experience, it's not moving right now.
The other thing is this, if you were to blow off the gas to decrease the pressure downstream of the pig and pull the pig in, if that pig gets stuck somewhere else, for instance, let's say instead of moving, it gets stuck somewhere and doesn't allow gas to flow by, then you're in trouble because you can't get gas to the city. This way the pig is in there somewhere, the gas is flowing by, our pressures are steady, they don't vary from day to day by maybe whatever the flow demand is. If there's a big demand of flow, of course, the pressure appear will be less. If the flow is like it is now, the pressure, what is it, 50 pounds that we dropped between Mina and the pier now, Gordy? Something like that? There's no problem. There could be a problem. I'm not going to sit here and tell you there couldn't be a problem. It's a mechanical device. It's driven by gas that pushes things sometimes and sometimes doesn't. There could be a problem. However, the problem is not as catastrophic as I believe Mr. Gergis thinks it is. We do have a bypass that allows us to bypass not only our pig trap, but their station and continue to serve gas to Pier. The question is the timing on it, as he so aptly points out. With the new alarm systems we put in, we on our end will be able to tell if there's a problem on our facility. We still can't tell if there's a problem on their facility. We'll be very happy to give them our alarms on a format for them, and they can give us theirs so that both of us can be out there when one of the alarms go off and we can take whatever action is necessary. But we can bypass their meter station and continue flow to the city of Pier. And we do that by opening the bypass valve and manipulating the pressure by manipulating the valve opening so that when the gas goes through, the pressure becomes suitable for their system.
Thank you, Mr. Woods. We're exploring this far beyond, I think, what we needed to at this juncture. However, I do want to have MDU an opportunity to respond to their ability to bypass. Just a comment, if you would.
That system was in place this last incident. It's basically what it is a reactionary thing. We react to the reason for it is if we have a regulator that starts to fail or has failed, or we have to replace equipment in there in order to keep gas flowing around that station, we have a bypass. That was in place the last instant, and the reason we were within minutes is because we did react quick enough and get that bypass flowing. But like we said, we were within minutes of that pier losing pressure. Once it loses pressure, that bypass becomes not a function that we can use. We have to shut the system down if we lose pressure to the point that it does not sustain a pilot light in a house, even one house.
Thank you. That would be another thing that I'd be interested in then, is the alarm system that was alluded to and the ability then to be able to react more quickly and provide that service to make sure that bypass is functioning as quickly as possible, shorten the duration as much as possible. Anything else that Commissioner Kolbeck?
Just maybe to expedite, I guess on staff revised recommendations number 4, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but both systems actually use a 1 micron filter, so I don't know what the time spent on that would be worth it for my benefit, I guess, is improved filtering systems. I mean, I'm sure you could spend anywhere from $10 to $10,000 on improved filter systems. But as long as both companies have the same 1 micron filter, I wouldn't need that information. I guess the other commissioners feel that it's necessary. We can discuss that. But on recommendation number 1, I would think that we just want alarms, environmental aspects of venting gas and the cost.
The environmental aspects we did address, and there are no permits required to release the gas.
Okay. Scratch that one. Alarms and costs.
Just alarms. And in regards to the filter, what I was thinking of in number 4 was a larger filter so that the debris load didn't impact it and collapse the filter, rather than changing the micron size, a bigger filter that it wouldn't physically impact it.
Sure. And I guess what I was referring to that is they both have the same, so I don't know if we would want to, whatever we do, we have to do to both. Whatever cost would be times 2, because you'd want both sides, because they're the same now, you'd want to keep them the same later. So I'm not necessarily prepared to do that. But I do want more information on getting that pig out of there.
Is there a motion from the commission? Would you like to...
PS08-001, I'll recommend approval of staff's revised recommendations 2, 3, and 4, but I would like further information on alarms and cost on staff recommendation number 1.
Discussion?
I don't know, I'd kind of like some information on filters. I didn't even think about them until Commissioner Hansen had mentioned the larger filter, and then Nathan kind of added some to that.
And I would definitely consider that a friendly amendment. That's just my personal feeling on it.
Commissioner Hansen, your thoughts on it? I mean, it sounds like you've got a little bit more experience with this than perhaps I do, so I'm interested in your take.
I think redundancy and larger screens and such are warranted under what I've heard so far, and it's something I'd certainly be interested in knowing more about, yes.
Commissioner Kolbeck, I don't think we've got any interest in voting your amendment, your motion down.
So
I'll amend the motion to, and I'll restate it, that we accept staff recommendations 2 and 3, ask for more information on staff recommendation number 1, including alarms and cost, and also more information on staff recommendation number 4 to improve filtering systems, including larger filters, to catch bigger debris.
Thank you. There are discussion on the motion. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. We've been having our entertainment here now for 2 hours, so we're going to take a 10 minute break, maybe 9 minutes and 58 seconds. But 10 minute break, and we'll start again. Thank you. When we're back, those of you who are listening to us on the web, you may have some challenges and wish to refresh your browser. We'll check right now to see who's on the line with us. And I should have checked before we started. How much time do we have before we are before we lose the? We're fine. You connect. Great. Mr. George Thompson.
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Colleen Savold.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Chris Madsen.
Still hanging in here, Mr. Chairman.
Joanne Doring.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Trying to say your name with a big smile at this point. Bob Schutzley.
Still here, sir.
Bill Vandersloos. Ryan Taylor.
Present, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, folks, for... I'm sure you know a lot more about natural gas and pigging than you ever wanted to know if you were listening in. But we will start now with telecommunications, TC06-181, in the matter of the petition of Venture Communications Cooperative for suspension or modification of local dialing parity reciprocal compensation obligations. On September 8th, 2008, Venture filed a motion to withdraw its petition. Ms. Northrup.
Good afternoon. This is Margo Northrup from the Ryder Rogers Law Firm here in Pierre on behalf of Venture Communications. This is actually a cleanup item. We settled this case with Altel back on October 3rd of 2007, and it's just been pending since that time. We filed a confidential stipulation in this docket and also the pending arbitration docket. So all we're requesting at this time is that we be allowed to withdraw our petition.
And the pending arbitration docket?
I knew you were going to ask me that. It's on the stipulation. Do you have it? I'm not sure. I think it's TC06-159. That was me, my guess.
Just wondering what your plans are there. Or if
we have actually been in contact with Altel, and we're trying to identify the outstanding issues, and we'll probably get that case going again in the near future.
Thank you. Ms. Wiest, did you have anything?
So you're not going to file an interconnection agreement? You still have outstanding issues?
Right. We still have outstanding arbitration issues.
And that's still over at OHE?
I don't think so. I think it's in front of the commission.
You might want to talk to arbitration. I can't see where. I could have missed it. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I couldn't find whether it was back before us or not.
I think as part of the settlement, we agreed to bring it back in front of the commission, and so maybe we just need to follow up on that. I'll do that.
Okay, and I certainly could have missed that, too.
Okay.
Because if there's a, you know, the arbitration, what, I think you need to check on the deadlines to make sure we're
not joining the meeting.
Deadlines if you're still actually working on the case.
Okay. We will do that.
It's my understanding from the stipulation that you would be filing an interconnection agreement.
Thank you. Anything else from staff that we need to cover at this juncture? Any questions by the commissioners? Is there a motion?
I'll file on TC06-181 that the commission grant the motion to withdraw and close this docket.
Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Yes.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes yes. The motion carries. TC07-128, in the matter of the filing by Sandcom Incorporated doing business with Mitchell Telecom for approval of its intrastate switch access tariff and for an extension of an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission approve the settlement stipulations? A settlement stipulation was filed on July 21, 2008. On the 29th of July, the commission considered Sandcom's motion to quash and deferred action. Do we need to do anything with the deferred action on that prior to taking action on the other portion of it?
Well, I think the outstanding item, I think it was just a day or so ago, Quest filed I think the motion to quash has been dealt with, at least the relevant part.
Is joining the meeting.
I think right now what we do have and what the commissioners need to be aware of is that Quest did file, and it was yesterday, filed a motion to withdraw its intervention. And remember, we had been holding up action on the approval of stipulation pending the outcome of that. And, of course, we've got Mr. Van Camp sitting here from AT&T, who's the other intervener, and we really haven't heard a lot from AT&T throughout this whole process. So we'll have to also get his take on this. But maybe we want to hear first from Quest to resolve their participation and their prior objections to approval of stipulation, and then we'll move on.
Thank you. We'll do that. we have Colleen, are you, who's the lead here?
Mr. Chairman, this is Chris Madsen, and I can handle this today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just as Mr. Smith pointed out, yesterday afternoon I did file a motion to withdraw our participation in this docket, and I would ask that the Commission favorably grant that motion, and that would take care of us as far as any need for our approval or disapproval or lack thereof with regard to the settlement stipulation. So even though the motion was only filed yesterday, a copy was served on Mr. Larson as well as Mr. Idol, who is listed on the service list on behalf of SANCOM. A copy was served on Ms. Kramer representing staff, and if no one would have any objections that I would need to address, I would ask that the Commission simply grant that motion, and you can proceed without us.
Can't imagine that there's going to be too much objection to that. Commission, any questions? Is there a motion?
I would move the Commission grant the quest motion.
Discussion, Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes yes. Thank you, folks, for staying with us all this period of time for that opportunity.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be heard, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be in touch sometime again on another matter.
Thank you.
I think now, Mr. Chairman, we move on to the question on the agenda.
And the question is, shall the Commission approve the settlement stipulation? Mr. Van Camp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and never cease to amaze the amount of information I learn in coming to these meetings. And very few things will ever drive me to enjoy telecom more than the study of pigs, but thank you. Bill Van Camp, I'm the in-state attorney for AT&T Communications of the Midwest. I would like to thank staff for the assistance in getting the discovery, which kind of held up the settlement earlier, and so we have gotten all the materials that we were due as a member of this docket from SANCOM. As such, AT&T does not object to the settlement reached between staff and SANCOM, while at the same time it's my job to read into the record that we reserve our rights in front of this commission and other forums to challenge any or further aspects of SANCOM's rates or tariffs, including but not limited to the application of the rates and tariffs and access stimulation matters.
Thank you, Bill. Anyone else wishing to testify on this item? Ms. Kramer, is this yours?
Yes, it is. Thank you. I can give you a short staff recommendation. Mr. Sanger has filed a memo. If you would want to hear from him first, I'm not sure what the preference is, if you have questions on the settlement. And I believe Mr. Larson has now joined us by phone. I believe that was he who earlier it came in. Jeff Larson is the attorney for SANCOM.
And Mr. Doring, I should hear from as well.
Yeah, that is their consultant from Telec or something.
All right.
Teltec or, so I'm not sure what, if you would want to hear from Mr. Sanger, who's been here a long time.
Mr. Sanger, welcome back.
Thank you. I guess I don't have a whole lot to say on the settlement. As Karen did mention, on I think it was July 25th of 08, I did file a staff memorandum in support of the settlement. Because of the time it has taken for this settlement to be approved, the only question that I have in my mind in preparing for the meeting earlier today was that the effective date of this settlement is July 1, 2008. That is the first step of the phase-in, SANCOM's rates down. The second step would be July 1, 2009. The third would be July 1, 2010, which ultimately at that point they will be at the quest rate. My belief is that the commission could probably approve the settlement as is, and thus SANCOM could go back in their rates. They agreed to it prior to July 1st, so I'm assuming that they've been tracking their their billings and everything and can possibly provide credits to those companies that they have overbilled had they been billing this rate of July 1, 2008, if the commission does approve this settlement. But if you have any questions, I'm here to do my best to answer those.
Thank you. And does Vantage, do you wish to have a statement at this time?
Yes, I would like to say this is Jolynn Doring of Vantage Point on behalf of SANCOM. And to speak on the point that Mr. Sanger had made about the effective date of July 1st, I think that SANCOM would probably prefer to move that date to a date in the future, like possibly October 1st, instead of going back and crediting, because we do know that SANCOM has been billing the current rates. They have not implemented the stipulation agreement rates yet. I would also, Mr. Chairman, like to pass it off to Jeff Larson to see if he has any further comments on that.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jeff Larson. I don't know if you can hear me. I'm kind of in a bad spot out here.
We can hear you very well. Thank you.
Thank you. And I agree. My client certainly wants the stipulation approved, but October 1st would certainly be a lot more convenient. We have been charging the old rate, and until the stipulation was actually approved, thought we needed to. So we would certainly ask the commission respectfully to adopt the settlement and to set it at October 1st.
Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Staff would ask that SANCOM be granted a waiver from the requirements of filing cost data. They would further ask that SANCOM be granted a waiver from the requirements of ARSD 2010-2712. And they would ask that the commission approve the stipulation without modification. As to the timing date, I agree with Mr. Sanger that it should be July 1. They agreed to that, and part of the reason it's now, you know, September, whatever we're in, 23rd, is SANCOM's reluctance to turn over data that they ultimately turned over. And I'm not sure they should gain from the benefit of that. I'm not saying they held up the process improperly or anything. They certainly had due process rights afforded to them, but some of this delay could certainly be attributed to them. And they agreed to July 1, and I don't believe it would be that big a problem for them to, I don't know that it would be back billing, whatever they need to do, but I think it should be July 1. Thank you.
All or nothing?
Well, okay, I'd take that modification, but because I don't want to start this all over again. But that would be staff's position that July 1 is the date they did agree to.
All right, thank you. Mr. Rislow, did you have something?
An observation more than a question. It doesn't seem as if any of our companies in South Dakota have any trouble going back in a case where the rates have increased in rebill, and I don't think it should be necessarily any different in a case where there's a decrease in the rebill. Just an observation. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes.
AT&T appeared today not to object to the stipulation as it was presented. If there is a date change in that, I do not have the authority to offer such lack of objection, and in that case would simply state that we would take no position if the date would be changed, and I'll leave that to your staff attorney to tell you what that means.
Thank you. One last shot, Ms. Doring. Jeff?
Mr. Chairman, we're not trying to be difficult here. We think this thing should be approved. You know, obviously it would be our preference to have it at October 1st, but we think it's in the best interest of everybody, including this commission, to get this docket closed.
Thank you. Questions by the commission? If not, is there a motion?
I motion TC07-128 that the commission approve
the settlement as per recommendations from staff.
Discussion on the motion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. Motion carries. Item 3 under telecommunications is TC08-034 in the matter of the application of BEK Communications Cooperative for a COA provide local exchange services in South Dakota. The questions to the commission are, shall the commission grant a COA to BEK Communications Cooperative? And at this time, we've also received, have we actually received an amended COA from Valley at this point? So is that one of the questions?
Staff could probably answer that. Do you want to clarify that?
Well,
just a yes or no. I'm going to finish the question, and we'll begin with all of the.
The questions are kind of mixed up, so I could tell you what I think the question could be.
Well, then, if the questions have changed, I won't read the questions.
It's kind of a combination of what you have in front of you. I think a couple of words got left out, and I didn't proof it well enough before it went out to have picked up on that.
All right. The last question is, shall the commission approve the territory boundary change? And we have some folks on the phone with us on TC08-034. Bob Schutzley.
Yes, here, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, Commissioner Hanson.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. This is Margo Northrup, an attorney from Ryder Rogers here in Pierce, South Dakota. I represent Valley Telecommunications. I have Bob Schutzley on the phone with me, who is the outside plant manager. He's probably never going to speak to me again, but I'd ask him to be here just in case there were any questions in reference to the boundaries and the history behind this.
You mean he hasn't been enjoying this?
Well, I'll find out later.
Okay, Margo.
Thanks, Bob. We started this process. Valley started this process in March. They approached three of their neighbors, so to speak, and asked them to amend their boundaries. And that would require us to get an amended certificate of authority. When we went to BEK, we realized that they have one customer in South Dakota and we have one customer in North Dakota. And so that required, after consultation with staff, both of us to get our certificate of authority in each other's respective territories. And so what I'm not representing BEK. I'm not sure if they have anyone on the phone. But I am representing Valley and requesting that the boundary change be approved between these two companies and that the certificate of authority be amended appropriately for Valley and that the administrative rules be waived, the requirements that don't apply to the boundary change. And I think that commission staff can probably, when she said that the question got mixed up, I think it just got left off. We also needed to have Valley Certificate of Authority amended.
Thank you. Ms. Kramer.
I'll have Dave Jacobson kind of give you a quick background, and then I'll make my recommendation. Thank you.
Mr. Jacobson?
Yes, this filing has gone through a number of gyrations since it was filed, and actually, what they're requesting at this time is a certificate of authority to provide local service and inter-exchange service. Now, at one time, it included alternative operator service, but that was subsequently dropped. But it is for a local and inter-exchange service certificates of authority. Beyond that, the applicant has met all the requirements for those, and we had recommend approval without any restrictions or bond or anything. If you have any questions, I'm sure try to answer them. Thank you.
So there is still a request for a COA for BEK Communications, and there is also a amended COA to Valley. That's before us?
Correct. BEK has been serving this customer. They bought the territory from Quest. And have been serving this customer since 96 and came to discover, I suppose, when Margo's group approached them, that they don't have a COA in South Dakota. And so they're seeking a certificate for local and inter-exchange to serve that one customer. So staff would recommend that the commission grant a certificate of authority for both local and interchange service to BEK, and it will be in a service area that is specifically described in responses to data requests to staff. It's a very small area. Then, so they don't really need a territory change because they don't have a territory at this point, or they don't, you know. They don't.
Well, that's and, what I was at.
Yeah, and that's then Valley the problem. Needs this, but, right.
Okay.
Valley is then carving out a portion of their territory to allow BEK to serve this customer. And so Valley, and so staff would recommend that Valley's request for amended certificate of authority with the waivers of ARSD 2010-3203, subsections 1 through 7, 9 through 21, and 23 be granted. And then I believe that will take care of what everybody needs here. BEK gets a COA, and Valley gets an amended COA.
And a territory boundary change.
And the territory boundary change, right, that doesn't, I mean, the only one getting anything is Valley.
Correct.
And so that question at the end really doesn't need to be there.
All right.
The way, if I might, Mr. Chairman, the way that a boundary change happens in the telephone business is via an amended COA.
Thank you. Thank you. Anything further from the staff at this time?
That would be it. Thank you.
Great. Did you have anything to, questions by the commission?
This is a heck of a deal from a cost-benefit analysis for BEK. They pay $250 COA annual charge, and they keep serving the same customer they've been serving.
Is that a good business plan? Any other questions, comments, motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the commission grant a COA to BEK and approve the amended COA for Valley Telecom.
According to conditions and...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, with a waiver as recommended by staff.
Discussion? Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. Motion carries. TC08-087, in the matter of the application of Novatel Limited Incorporated for a COA to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. Today, shall the commission grant a COA to Novatel Limited Incorporated? Ms. LeBron?
Thank you, Commissioner.
I'm just assuming that I don't see that anyone's on the telephone with us from Novatel, so Ms. LeBron Baker.
Thank you. On May 30th, 2008, Novatel submitted an application for a certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. The applicant has met the requirements for granting a certificate of authority. Staff recommends that the commission grant an inter-exchange certificate of authority to Novatel, subject to the restrictions that Novatel not offer any prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and not accept or require any deposits or advance payments without the prior approval of the commission.
Thank you. Any questions by members of the commission? Is there anyone in the line with us that wishes to discuss this item? Motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move the commission grant the COA.
Discussion. Mr. Johnson.
Aye.
Mr. Kolbeck.
Yeah, aye.
Hansen votes aye. Motion carries.
That motion was per staff recommendations, obviously.
Yeah, but I should have said it anyway. So that's good to know. Certainly, if either of you decide you were voting on a motion different than that, we can do a do-over. So.
No, it's understood that the conditions as requested by staff were part of the motion.
Yeah. Still, I should have said it, though. Thanks for the catch. That's twice in a row now.
That's because we put all the burden on you to make the motions. Item 5, TC08-104, in the matter of the application of and Ventus Telecom Incorporated for a COA to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. The question for the commission is, shall the commission grant a COA to Ventus Telecom Incorporated? And we have Mr. Vandersloos on the telephone with us. Bill, are you there?
No, he wasn't.
Oh, that's right. I have him on my list, but he was not going to join us. I just didn't believe that. I assumed that anyone would eventually want to join us. I'll turn to Ms. LeBray-Baker then.
Thank you. On August 13, 2008, Inventus Telecom filed an application for a certificate of authority to provide internet exchange service throughout the state of South Dakota. The applicant has met the requirements for granting a certificate of authority and has provided staff with all of the necessary information that we requested. Inventus has asked for a waiver from ARSD 2010-24029 to the extent that it requires a cash flow statement. Staff recommends the commission grant the waiver request and grant an inter-exchange certificate of authority to Inventus.
Thank you. Questions by commissioners? Motion?
I'll motion in TC08-104 that the commission grant the certificate of authority to Inventus Telecom per staff's recommendations.
Discussion. Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck.
Aye.
Hansen votes yes. Motion carries. TC08-105 in the matter of the application of Mid-Continent Communications for approval to provide local exchange service in rural service area. Today, shall the commission grant intervention to Alliance Communications? And I believe we've received from Alliance Communications a request to intervene?
Yes.
As well as to the South Dakota Telecommunications Association. And are we going to proceed with this item, or is this going to be deferred?
We can go ahead with the Alliance and then talk about the SDTA.
All right. We'll proceed with the Alliance item first. Mr. Taylor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Ryan Taylor with Cutler and Donahue, appearing on behalf of Alliance Communications Cooperative. Alliance Communications has requested intervener status in this docket, as it is the incumbent local exchange carrier in both Baltic and Crook. And pursuant to the administrative regs of the commission and state statute, we are entitled to intervener status, as mentioned in our brief.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Is Mid-Continent on the line with us?
This is Karen Kramer from staff. Did somebody else answer from them? Mr. Gertis, I talked to him earlier today, and I don't know if he forgot he had this one on here, but he did say he had no objection to Alliance being granted intervention. So
I was also served with discovery by Mid-Continent while on the call, so I'm
all right.
And staff would recommend granting intervention to Alliance and then deferring the matter with SDTA. They asked for an opportunity to file written comment to Midco's objection to their intervention.
Thank you. Any questions by the commission? Did you have anything to add? Is there a motion?
I'll motion TC08-105. That the commission grant intervention to Alliance Communications. And do we need to mention SDTA at a later date or just?
We'll just
and,
refer
we'll
that
pick
one.
Up SDTA, South Dakota Telecommunications Association intervention at a later date. Is that a good motion?
Discussion on the motion. Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen votes aye. The motion carries. Item number 7 is TC 08-106 in the matter of the filing by Sprint Communications Company LP for approval of access of its access service tariff. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the access service tariff? Mr. Knadel.
I think John maybe want to take this. He's smiling over there, but no. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman.
Mr. Gerber.
He doesn't have a microphone. We can fix that.
This is Bob Knadel. Sprint filed for commission approval revisions to its access service tariff number 3, which relate to the introduction of toll-free database access service vertical feature query functionality. The company has requested an effective date of September 15th for the tariff changes. There are no interventions filed. And per commission order and docket TC07-091, dated October 2nd, 2007, Sprint was allowed to mere Qwest Corporation's switched access rates and file adjustments to its Swiss access rate so long as those adjustments are either mere Quest Corporation rates or lower or until the commission shall otherwise order. Sprint's proposed rate for the new service is lower than Quest rates for a comparable service. Usually when you're talking about mirroring Quest rates, you're usually talking about switching, carrier common line, and transport. So if the commission deems it's necessary to approve these changes, staff would recommend approval with an effective date of September 15th as proposed by Sprint.
Thank you, Mr. Knadel. Commission questions? Discussion? Motion? I guess we need the motion before we have a discussion.
I motion the TC08-106 that the Commission approve the access service tariff effective September 15th, 2008. Is that all of your recommendations? Just that it be...
Yes.
We accepted it effective September 15th, 2008.
Discussion? Mr. Johnson?
Aye.
Mr. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson votes aye. The motion carries. Next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held October 7 at 9:30 in room 423 of the State Capitol Building. Commission meetings are scheduled for October 21 and November 12. Public Utilities Commission offices will be closed Monday, October 13th in observance of Native American Day. Commissioners and staff will be attending the Narrook Fall Meetings in New Orleans, November 16th. Public Utilities Commission offices will be closed Tuesday, November 11th in observance of Veterans Day. Public Utilities Commissions will be closed Thursday, November 27th in observance of Thanksgiving. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
I have a motion to adjourn. All those in favor signify by saying yes. All those opposed signify by saying no. Motion carries. We're adjourned.